This podcast was recorded Thursday, April 6th at 11:05 a.m. Things may have changed by the time you hear this. Like, we will return to a time when getting indicted for paying hush money to an adult film star is not seen as a political advantage. Let's talk politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and all those shrewd politicians, those Snollygosters who raise lots of money for being arrested. I'm Mike Thompson. Steve Brown is off this week. Coming up on the podcast, now it is conservatives who want to defund the police. But first, you know, we're always looking to boost listening to our podcast. We look for interesting and engaging topics. Things that will keep listeners tightening their earbuds, turning up the volume on their car radio. So this week, we have found an absolutely riveting topic, constitutional law. Really, constitutional law, and we promise to have more fun than you ever had in a law class. Of course, the Constitution, namely the Ohio Constitution, is in the news because people want to change it. A group of supporters of abortion rights is collecting signatures to get an amendment on the November ballot that would guarantee abortion rights in the Ohio Constitution. And in an effort to make that effort more difficult, Republican lawmakers at the State House want to change the Constitution before the November vote to make it harder to change the Constitution. The proposal would increase the requirements for signatures to get on the ballot, and then the amendment would have to get at least 60% of the vote to get approved. Right now, of course, it just takes a simple majority. Advocates of the 60% threshold say the higher bar would protect the Ohio Constitution from special interests. Joining us now is an expert on Ohio's Constitution. Mike Curtin is the former associate publisher of the Columbus Dispatch. He served two terms in the state legislature as a Democrat representing a Columbus suburb. He's the co-author of the book, The Ohio Politics Almanac, and he is a baseball and softball umpire, so he knows how to call balls and strikes. He also fiercely opposes this current attempt to require a 60% vote margin to change the state's constitution. Mike Curtin, welcome to Snollygoster.
Thank you, Mike, very much.
Can I ask, which is easier, politics or umpiring a baseball and softball game?
Well, the baseball and softball are much easier to understand. The rules don't change too much. You know, everything is out there on the field. There's nothing behind closed doors. There's no hidden agendas. Everything is visible and transparent. So that is a big advantageous thing for baseball and softball.
Absolutely. All right. Before we get into the debate over the 60% threshold proposal, let's take that step back. We are governed by two constitutions, of course, the U.S. Constitution, and we Ohioans have the Ohio Constitution, like other states have theirs. First question, Mike, why do we have two constitutions?
Well, a nation needs a constitution, obviously. So in 1787, the founders of our country had a constitutional convention to draft a constitution for how this new nation would turn out to be a very large nation from sea to shining sea would be formed and how it would operate. And there were tremendous debates at that constitutional convention in Philadelphia. And the product that finally was that emerged from that constitutional convention was a fairly lean document. Even after being amended 27 times over the decades, it still has fewer than 8,000 words because the founders knew that this very large, sprawling nation from sea to sea would have a lot of diverse populations. The states would be very diverse, serving those populations, different tribes, if you will, different types of people. They came to the conclusion that most scholars think was a very wise one, to reserve certain powers to the federal constitution, obviously war-making powers, interstate commerce, the treasury function, who would issue the bills and the coinage, and obviously Army, Navy, those sorts of things. But in terms of the detail of governance, they wanted to leave that to the states. And that's what federalism is. The federal constitution would be a lean, mean document, reserving certain powers only to the federal government. But the day-to-day management of our public affairs out in our states and what became counties and townships and cities will be left to the locals. And that's why the Ohio Constitution and all state constitutions are longer, most of them much longer than the U.S. Constitution, because the U.S. Constitution, for example, doesn't contain one word about education, doesn't contain one word about lots and lots of things that state constitutions have to deal with: state judiciaries, state taxing power, state debt, state transportation systems. I mean, all the things we take for granted as governmental functions, most of them are state functions and functions of the subdivisions of that state, counties, cities, and townships.
You need a constitution to lay that all out rather than just statutes. It's important to have a state guiding document more so than just laws that can be put on the books.
Well, sure. Take education, for example. We have 612 or so school districts in the state. They will manage their local schools, but you have to have an overarching system that those districts have to abide by. You want to have a uniform educational system that sets standards and guidelines for how we're going to educate our kids. Whether it's whether we're going to have an elected judiciary or an appointed judiciary, as you know, that varies from state to state very much. And a lot of things vary state to state. And that's what the founders intended, because different populations in different states would want things run different ways.
Yeah. You mentioned the U.S. Constitution has about 7,600 words. The Ohio Constitution has nearly 60,000 words, eight times longer. The Alabama Constitution is 345,000 words. It's the longest in the country. You need that many words, you believe, Mike, to get into that, the details, the nuance of what states should be involved in?
Well, that's for state populations to decide. Bill Batchelder, who you knew, the legendary conservative, the legendary state constitutionalist.
He of the very large glasses.
It were very large glasses. He was a judge. He was also, for 38 years, over two different stints, 38 years, was a leader among Republicans in the General Assembly. And he was, at the end of his career, as you know, House Speaker. And one of his famous sayings about the Ohio Constitution, when people would criticize its length, Batchelder would say, specificity is good. You can't have specificity without length. And in his view, he was a small government, type. He always was trying to limit government. And he said, you can't limit governmental functions without words. And so if he were alive today, and it's a proverb that one should never speak for the dead, but I'm quoting him directly, because this was from a 2008 interview I did with Bill Batchelder. He said, the Ohio Constitution, which is the ninth longest in the nation, has a lot of detail, a lot of words, but that's good because it helps us tie down government more. And the best example of that is Article 8 in our Ohio Constitution, which is the article on public debt and public finance. And that Article 8 alone accounts for 40% of all the words in the Ohio Constitution. Why? Because our state constitution still has a debt limit of $750,000. That's an 1851 debt limit that's never been taken out of the state constitution, despite the attempts of Jim Rhodes to twice take it out.
You can't buy a big house for $750,000.
Pardon me? No, you can't. And so when governors and general assemblies over the decades have wanted to do things that they have to do, build roads and highways and schools and all sorts of other public buildings, do environmental conservation, do the third frontier, which was done under Bob Taft, you have to issue debt and you have to have voters approve that debt, because the Constitution doesn't allow the state to run up debt without voter approval. When Frank LaRose and Brian Stewart, who proposed this 60% thing, say we need a lean, mean constitution, my answer is, well, you better be careful, because maybe half, if that, of the bond issues over the last 30 years have gotten a 60% approval rate. Most don't. Most get the ones that pass, mostly pass between 50 and 58%. And so they're asking for trouble with bond issues if they put a 60% threshold in place.
Yeah. Another thing is, it is extremely hard to change the U.S. Constitution. You need two-thirds of the House, two-thirds of the Senate, and three-quarters of all of the states to approve the change. So good luck getting that in this day and age. You argue it should not be that hard to change the state constitution, and that's what this movement is to make it significant, well, fairly, by a fairly significant amount, make it harder to change the Ohio Constitution. Why should it not be harder to change the Constitution than it is now?
Because we shouldn't trust the state house politicians any more than we trust them now. The reason that we have the constitutional initiative power in our state constitution, the reason we've had it since 1912, is that those delegates to the 1912 Ohio Constitutional Convention were trying to clean up a corrupt state house. And they believe that every once in a while that that state house is going to be beholden to special interests, which it was in that day, and I believe it is today. And so those delegates offered a proposed amendment to the electorate in a special election in September of 1912 to adopt a proposed 42 new amendments to the state constitution. 34 were approved. One of those was the initiative and referendum power. It passed by a landslide, 57.5%. And since then, that initiative has been needed time and time again for the people to set the state house straight.
57%.
Now, they haven't abused,
57%
they haven't
abused wouldn't
that
have,
power. They've used that power very judiciously over the decades.
Yeah, 57% wouldn't have passed under this 60% threshold thing.
No, I mean, by definition, 55 to 45 is a landslide. You beat somebody by double digits, you win an issue by double digits, you've achieved a landslide. 60% is a huge landslide, and it's being proposed for one reason only. The whole state house crowd knows it. It's not for good government purposes. It's meant to stop one issue and one issue only.
Yeah. 19 states, only 19 states allow citizens to change their constitutions. Ohio is one of them, but we're in the minority. Are other states behind the curve? Why do you think that more states have not adopted this? Voters in more states have not clamored for this.
Clamored for the 60%?
No, for the right to change the Constitution themselves and not rely on lawmakers.
Well, if you look at the history of the initiative power, it started out west. South Dakota was the first state in which voters adopted the initiative power back in 1898. Then Utah, Oregon, Montana, Nevada, Oklahoma, Missouri, Michigan. Then, so the first seven essentially were western states of their day. And if you look at why the initiative power got rolling in those states, it tended to be the states that were owned by the robber barons, the states where the robber barons held sway over the commerce of the state and held the people down. So, for example, in South Dakota in 1898, what caused those farmers in South Dakota to rise up and claim the initiative power? Well, it's because the state house and the state economy was owned by the grain merchants, the grain monopolists who controlled the warehousing, who controlled the railroad, who controlled the means of transferring their product to market. And they kept squeezing and squeezing and squeezing the farmers so they couldn't even make a profit anymore as they gouged them for higher and higher prices all the time. And so those South Dakota farmers took matters into their own hands and said, we're going to clean up the state house with the initiative power. And the states that followed, and there are a lot of differences from state to state, of course, but if you're looking for a common thread, the common thread is the people wanted to trust themselves more than they wanted to trust the state house politicians. And that was certainly true in Ohio, because in the late 1800s, early 1900s, Ohio was owned by the robber barons, and a whole flock of state legislators were literally in the pockets of the big trusts, the banking trust, the utility trust, the railroad trust, the oil trust, the steel and iron trusts. It wasn't against the law for corporate money to be flowing right into their pockets. And they took advantage of it back then. We didn't have any ethics laws back in the day. And the great reformers of the late 1800s, early 1900s in Ohio, Tom Johnson in Cleveland, Samuel Golden Rule Jones in Toledo, Washington Gladden in Columbus, advocated, lobbied for a state constitutional convention, got it, and insisted during the proceedings of that 1912 constitutional convention that we need to give our people the right to adopt the initiative. And they did, and they set to work to clean up the state house.
One more thing on the Constitution and possibly changing how the rules to change it. The Constitutional Modernization Commission looked at raising the threshold to 55%, which you just said, it still would be a landslide election, but it's somewhat less than 60. But the commission also called for an easier process to change state law. So it wasn't 55% all by itself. It was, okay, it's going to be harder to change the Constitution, but we won't have to change it as frequently if we make it easier to change state laws. Is that something we should look at down the road?
Well, it wasn't the commission that recommended that. It was one committee of the commission.
Okay, one committee.
The Ohio Constitutional Modernization Commission, which met from 2011 to 2017, was a 32-member body. I was on it for 4 years mm-hmm. when I was in the House. And it was broken up into committees to look at various parts of the Constitution. The committee that looked at this issue was called the CRU, the Constitutional Revisions and Updating Committee of that commission. And I was on that committee. We did a deep dive. We compared Ohio's initiative power to that of other states. We all agreed from right to left that too many statutory-like provisions do make their way into the Constitution over time, such as livestock care standards, for example, or casinos, or pick your favorite. And so we were looking for a solution to incentivize the initiated statute process and get more groups to choose that route rather than the constitutional route, because we do get some provisions in the Constitution that are more fit for statute than the constitutional bedrock. So after studying many states and the history of initiated law, the committee recommended to the full commission that we make the initiated statute process easier. It's only been successfully used three times since 1913. It's seldom used because there's no protection in it. A group can go to the time and trouble of organizing an initiated statute process, that is to put a new law in the Ohio Revised Code, get it approved by the voters, and the next day the General Assembly can wipe it out. There's no safe harbor provision. So some states that offer their citizens the initiated statute process also offer a safe harbor, so that if you do adopt it, you know, it'll be safe for a while from us messing with it. So what the committee recommended, taking the threshold for passing initiated constitutional amendments from the current 50% plus one to 55, we thought 55 wasn't too onerous if you also provided the other half of the loaf, and that is making the initiated statute process easier. So we recommended, instead of a overall 6% signature requirement, which is 3% up front, if you gather 3% of the signatures of people from the last gubernatorial election, you submit your proposed law to the General Assembly. And if they don't adopt it, you have to go back out on the street and collect another 3%. But you have to do that in 90 days, mm-hmm. which is a horrible time compression to gather that many signatures. And then even if you do that and get it successfully placed on the ballot, as I said, it can be enacted only to have the General Assembly override you. So we recommended a safe harbor provision of 5 years. Give the initiated statute process an easier route by having an upfront 5% signature requirement, get rid of the supplementary petition, and create a safe harbor provision of 5 years where the General Assembly can't touch it unless they can muster a two-thirds vote to amend it or change it. And we also recommended that initiated amendments could appear only in even-numbered general elections. Currently, they can appear in November of either odd-number or even-numbered years. We thought that that combination of proposals could create a balance, but nobody bought it.
Yeah.
Once it was advanced, groups came out from the left and the right, and they were suspicious of it. They thought perhaps it was too much change. Perhaps we didn't have a long enough gestation period for people to study it and debate it. And because of the wholesale opposition we ran into, it got tabled. And so it's been on the shelf since 2017.
Yeah. Taking a fair amount of power away from the legislature. If they had, like, for instance, the marijuana question, that's an initiated statute process. They are waiting to see if the legislature will enact their law as written. And if they don't, they'll go back out for signatures. But as you said, they could win in November and legislature comes back in December and nullifies it. So we'll have to see how that works out. Getting to the current debate, Mike, anything new in that debate? The push for the August election is the latest effort to try to get this 60% threshold question on the August ballot, which technically, as of tomorrow, I believe, is illegal to have an August election, Friday. What's the latest you've heard on that effort?
Well, the arm twisting is going on. The conventional wisdom around Capitol Square is that Matt Huffman has the votes in the Senate. He needs 20 votes, which is 3/5 of the Senate. Once the Senate and House members come back from Easter break, the expectation is he'll move that out of the Senate over to the House, and then the real arm twisting begins. The thinking is that the 60 votes aren't there right now in the House, that they're at least 8 or 10 short of 60. There are many House Republicans who have grave reservations about a 60% threshold being too high. There's many different reasons for that thought. So we'll know in short order, where this thing is headed based on whether those 6 or 8 hold firm or whether some of them cave to get to 60. As you know, the Republicans control 67 seats in the House, but there's 2 vacancies, so it's 65.
Yep.
And so you only need 6 holdouts, to keep them from getting to their 60, and that's the whole ball game right now.
You know, we always try to look at elections around the country and try to figure out, will they affect us here in Ohio? Do we read too much into them? But can't help but look at what happened in Wisconsin this week. Democrat Janet Protasiewicz easily won a seat on the state Supreme Court in a race that largely focused on abortion rights and gerrymandering reform. Sounds familiar. What do you think, Mike? Will that election embolden Republicans to move forward with this 60% effort, or will it give them pause because of the way the voters turned out for this April election in Wisconsin, not an August election, an April election?
I think the Wisconsin result emboldens them to go for broke and to do everything they can to have an August election. They know what the polls say. The polls have been consistent in Ohio for the last couple of years that if you have a proposed amendment that looks very much like the one being circulated, that it gets somewhere between 55 and 58% support in the polls. The Republicans know that, and so they're hell-bent to try to get a special election where the turnout would be typically low, and that's what this whole August thing is all about. I need to point out, you can't point this out enough, Mike, that if they do schedule an August election for this proposed amendment, which is monumental, changing 111 years of our history, it'd be the first time ever in our 220-year history of being a state where a General Assembly had the audacity to do that. Yeah. We've never done it before. We had an August 1926 vote, but that was back when our primaries were in August. From 1914, the first direct primary under the Ohio Constitution, when the voters took the nomination process away from the party conventions and took it under themselves. Since that, from 1914 through the 20s, our statewide primaries for nominating state and county candidates were in August. So that was the standard primary election. Since then, there's never been an August election, and there's never been a special election for Ohio voters to consider a proposed amendment to the Constitution. That's how outlandish this proposal is, to hold this election to accomplish one thing, and that's to torpedo a women's reproductive rights amendment.
If it comes to it, it's going to be a interesting campaign, and the campaign against it, as you just laid out, kind of writes itself, but it all comes down to turnout. Mike Curtin, former publisher, associate publisher with the Dispatch, former state rep, also one of the leading opponents to the 60% threshold movement at the State House. Thanks for joining us here on Snollygoster.
Thank you very much, Mike. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike. We'll be right back.
It started as a normal day.
What if the truth about the greatest tragedy of your life was kept secret from you?
Huge explosion occurred.
This is the story of a scandal deliberately buried in the chaos of the Iraq War.
What really just happened?
Listen to NPR's Embedded podcast and its latest series, Taking Cover.
Time now for our Snollygoster of the Week segment, where we honor the shrewdest politician or political move of the week. And this week it is Congressman Jim Jordan for saying this in an interview on Fox News.
We control the power of the purse, and we're going to have to look at the appropriations process and limit funds going to some of these agencies, particularly the ones who are engaged in the most egregious behavior.
So the DOJ and the FBI.
Yeah.
If you didn't catch that, Jim Jordan wants to defund the police. Those agencies he's talking about is the FBI and the Department of Justice. This is very different from his party's stance and his own stance against defunding law enforcement on the local and state level. The thing that has changed, well, of course, law enforcement is investigating former President Donald Trump. The New York indictment is done. We know all about that. We're not going to talk any more about that this week. But Donald Trump does face possible charges in Georgia for election tampering and trying to interfere with the results there, as well as possible federal charges related to January 6th and the insurrection and his removal and reluctance to return classified documents found at his home in Florida. Jordan and Trump and a few other Republicans on the MAGA side say the investigations are political and they want to end funding for the Justice Department until, as Trump says, they come to their senses. Coming to our senses is such a relative term these days. That'll do it for this week's edition of Snollygoster, which is part of the NPR network. As always, please be sure to leave us a good review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your friends about us. Spread the word. Keep this podcast going and going strong. So for our student producer, Katie Genius, our digital producer, Michael DeBonis, and one last farewell and many, many thanks to our audio producer, Eric French, who leaves us this week for greener pastures. Eric, we'll miss you. I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media. We'll be right back.